refuse to be silenced, and I will help others raise their voices against hate.
I will listen, learn, speak up, and take actions.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
And good afternoon. It is 4 o'clock, and thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Coming up on the show today, in the first hour from an August 14th book launch and reading event at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Jade Wallace launching her new novel, or their new novel. Jade Wallace launching their new novel. I was reading the wrong line here. Jade Wallace launching their new novel, Anomia, followed by readings from Meg Freer, Myna Wallen launching her latest poetry collection, The Suicide Tourist, A.E. Best, whose next poetry collection, Bad Weather Mammals, is about to launch, and Gary Barwin, whose selected fiction collection, Scandal at the Alphorn Factory, is now available. And this segment does run about 15 minutes into the next hour. I'm going to air it uninterrupted. In the second hour, we'll finish up, again, the launch from the first hour, and then beginning about 15 minutes or so into the second hour, you'll hear from an August 15th launch event held at Homesick Potter Studio in Berryfield here. A chapbook launch, Jason Heru and Michael Glover. The chapbook is called Where We Left Off, and it's a follow-up to their 2014 chapbook collaboration, Quinoa Cake Recipe. Jason read his poetry, and Michael's good friend, Gerhard Pratt, read Michael's poetry because Michael couldn't be here, but he did join the event while he was a guest joiner. He attended, how's that, the event virtually and listened to everything, and every once in a while you'll hear him in there as well. Anyway, first thing, my usual start of the hour announcement. Occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. Let's go ahead and just start with, again, the August 14th event featuring Jade Wallace, Meg Freer, Myna Whalen, Ashley Elizabeth Best, and Gary Barwin. Again, this does run about 15 minutes into the second hour. Let's go ahead and bring it up now.
Attention, students.
Hi, everyone.
And you're gonna
thank you all for coming out tonight to this reading. We have a lot of authors lined up, so we will get right to it. Trying to think if there are any housekeeping things. I know there's a bathroom at the back. And yeah, I think we're going to go for about an hour or so, so we probably won't do like much of an intermission or anything. But anyways, I'm Jade Wallace. I sort of gathered some writers together for this reading, as I'm really looking forward to it. It is technically the Kingston launch for my debut novel, Anomia. I am uncharacteristically going to read first, just because that is my personal preference, and then we'll get to enjoy all the other readers. So I'm going to bug my partner, Mark, to read the bio, because it feels weird to read your own third-person bio.
Do it, yes.
Oh, I didn't even put mine on here. You have to make it up.
I will. I'm not good at improv.
This is a good test.
Oh, is there something in here? Is there something in here?
Yeah, that's true.
I'll read this one.
He's only known me for 6 years.
Jade Wallace, They Them, is a queer writer, editor, and critic, as well as co-founder of the collaborative writing entity MADE. Wallace is the author of two poetry collections, Love is a Place, but You Cannot Live There, which came out in 2023, and forthcoming in 2026, The Work is Done When We Are Dead, both with Guernica Editions. Maid's poetry debut poetry collection Zoo will be out in spring 2025 with Palimpsest Press. Anomia.
Thank you, Mark. We did a launch here last year, and we had like a formal host, and it was a little bit more official seeming, but we're we have enough readers. I don't feel like we also need a host, so we're just going to go with this. Yeah. So my novel, all I'm going to be reading from is a little excerpt from my novel today. I think all you need to know about it is there are basically two things. The gist of the story is that it's a missing person's story. Two people in town have gone missing. The police are not super interested, but a friend of theirs is and is sort of pursuing this case. In the meantime, an elderly resident of the local trailer park has found some bones in a nearby forest. And there are also two teenagers who live at the trailer park as well. And they are noticing what the person who's found the bones is up to and are kind of trailing them. And all the characters obviously are going to come to a head as the novel progresses. But the unusual thing about the novel, so it's this missing person story, but what is unusual about it as a literary conceit is there is no reference to sex or gender throughout the book, so you don't ever find out the sex or gender identity of any of the characters in it. And I'm going to just read from the second chapter. I don't think you really need any much more context to get into it. So this is the second chapter. It is called Bear. Euphoria is a small town, so it still has one video rental store. Euphoria is such a small town that it has only ever had one video rental store. Standing at the cash register behind the glass counter that displays the scenic covers of special release movies and a brigade of posed action figures, Fear, who is average in most discernible ways and softening with middle age, often looks like a drooping background mannequin in a museum exhibit. The store is called Utopia Video. On Fear's first day of work many years earlier, the store owner had explained, "I was going to call it Euphoria Video, but then my friend said that made it sound like we were selling adult films, and I had to change it." Fear nodded in agreement, but privately thought Utopia Video was a worse name, the kind a person would give to a religious shop with a conversion mission. Utopia means no place, Fear had said, not knowing what else to say. "Oh, we've got a linguist here," the store owner smirked. "We had to read about it in high school," Fear replied apologetically. As the years went by, however, Fear began to think that Utopia was in fact the perfect name for a video rental store in a town that seemed displaced in both space and time. Euphoria, an idle town built on fertile soil. The four seasons change continually, but the basic form of the town does not. Cozily harbored from the rest of the world by vast swaths of surrounding forest, farmland, and freshwater lakes, Euphoria is forever buffering, culturally and technologically, decades behind the progress of the nearest cosmopolitan centers. The metropolises are a few hours' ride by car or by the intercity bus that runs twice daily, once in the morning and once at night, between Euphoria and everywhere else, except, of course, on Sundays. Distance mutes signals. Even the blockbusters persistently arrive a year late to Utopia, and the closest the store actually gets to adult films is some tender-hearted softcore from the late 20th century, that last Arcadian decade before internet porn took hold of clandestine fantasy. For most of Fear's tenure at Utopia Video, the shop has had a quiet, dusty feel to it, even when freshly cleaned. But for the past year, ever since two people Fear knew had gone missing, working at the store has been more interesting than ever before. Each customer doubles as a suspect in the disappearance. Fear scrutinizes their rings for signs of recent cleaning, examines their shoes for neglected stains, and glances covertly into their opened wallets for IDs that are not their own as they extract credit cards and cash. There had been a close call about 8 months ago, late at night, right before Fear was about to close up. A customer, thick as a stone pillar, came into the store with jeans covered in dark smudges. "Painting?" Fear asked casually, evergreen-flecked eyes fixed inexorably on the customer's knees. "Butchering," the customer said. Blood drained from Fear's face. The customer saw it and clarified as if to a child, "Butchering cows." "Oh," Fear said, and laughed the way people do when their nervous energy has nowhere else to go. Nothing of concern has happened at the video store since that night, until two teenagers, limber and sprightly, wander in amidst the emptiness of this Thursday evening. They are typical lollygaggers in dirty sneakers and hooded sweatshirts, only differentiable insofar as one of them is several inches taller than the other. Fear does not say anything, not even to ask if they need help finding a film, but watches the kids closely under the pretense of making sure that the young suspects aren't stashing shop merchandise in their backpacks. The kids go to the horror movie section, which Fur regards as the second most suspicious section of the store, right after the true crime documentary shelves. The kids seem as indifferent to Fur as they are to the popcorn machine, which is exactly as Fur would have it. The taller kid picks up two movies and shows their covers to the shorter kid. "You have to be one of these monsters," the taller kid says. "Which is it going to be?" "Ugh," the shorter kid replies, looking from one movie to the other. "I guess the one with fewer scabs." "Fewer scabs, but more hair," the taller kid points out, and the shorter kid shrugs. "Would you rather date a poltergeist?" the shorter kid asks in return, holding up two more movies, "or an animate skeleton?" Fur struggles to focus on their conversation. The kids are loud enough, in fact, they seem unaware of how unnecessarily loud they are, but Fur is immediately bored by their inconsequential chatter. Teenagers, Fur surmises, probably all seem the same to people who are middle-aged and without children of their own to care for, people for whom adolescence is a vestige of their past, a homeland to which they will never return. "Can you even touch poltergeist?" the taller kid asks. "I don't know. They must be able to touch you, though, right? If they can move furniture," the shorter kid replies. "I date the poltergeist, I guess, who at least has impressive powers. A walking skeleton just seems like half a human." "That's true," the shorter kid says, putting the cases back on the shelves. "Hey," the taller kid says, a bit quieter and more somber than before, looking intently toward the shorter kid, who has started moving slowly down the row of shelves, oblivious to the creeping seriousness of their conversation. The taller kid presses on. "Speaking of, like, skeletons." "Let's get this one," the shorter kid interrupts. "Listen, a group of teens discover what seems to be a corpse in the local recluse's basement when they enter the house on a dare. Now the neighborhood psychopath is out to get them, and they'll have to use all their wits to keep from being killed before they can figure out how to prove to the cops that they're telling the truth about the body they saw. Little do they know, the corpse was not a corpse, and their neighbor is actually a vampire." "Cool, yeah," the taller kid monotones. "So what I was trying to say... Or what about this one? Zombie rabbits have taken over a small town, and the children are delighted. There's not one vegetable left to eat." "Malapert, can you listen for 1 second? The taller kid hisses. Feet motionless, the shorter kid's head pivots warily sideways, baffled eyes peering back toward where the taller kid stands, furiously still. "What's wrong with you?" "I have something fucking important to tell you, Mal," the taller kid says, solemnly and forcefully. Malapert, who evidently goes by Mal under ordinary circumstances, finally turns fully around to face the other, still looking confused. "Okay, Lim," Mal says. Lim must be the name of the taller kid, Fur decides. "What?" "You know that person in the trailer park who's really small and really old, like probably the oldest in the whole park?" "Yeah." "So I was walking around the park by myself the other day, nothing to do, just completely bored." Without noticing it, Fur stops mechanically polishing the glass countertop and is instead fossilized in place, listening intently. "You can't judge me," Lim adds, peering down at Mal with pleading eyes. "Sure," Mal agrees. "No, promise me you won't." "Oh, come on, I'm not judgmental." "You are." "Am not." "Then promise." "Fine, I promise." "Well, sometimes when people aren't home, I look in their windows." "Really? You said you wouldn't. This better be worth all the buildup." "I saw something in the small old person's window." "Obviously. What did you see?" "I think they were bones," Lim says, staring down meaningfully at Mal. Fur drops the glass polishing rag to the ground, but does not move to pick it up. "Bones," Mal repeats, nonplussed. "Human bones," Lim clarifies impatiently. "What, like the whole skeleton just lying there in the trailer?" "No, like a pile of bones sticking out of the top of a backpack." "Well, how do you know it wasn't just a couple of bones? How do you know they were human bones?" "I don't know for sure, but they seemed human." "Okay, right, okay. Did you tell anyone else?" "No, just you." "Are you going to tell anyone else?" "Maybe. Do you think I should?" "You could." "Who should I tell? Who would you tell?" "My parents, probably." "What about the police?" "I don't know. I guess they'd see what my parents thought first." "Hmm." The kids continue their slow shuffle through the aisles, but they do not talk anymore. Fur retrieves the dropped rag, places it on a shelf of the cabinet next to the cash register, grabs a stack of movies that had been returned earlier, and begins sluggishly ambling through the aisles of the shop floor, restocking the shelves. Fur reflects on the progress of the situation so far. Lim had said the bones were in a trailer. There are two trailer parks in Euphoria, the nearer one on the edge of the suburbs, and the farther one on the border between farms and forest. Euphoria is a cheap place to stop on the way to larger tourist cities. The trailer parks make the most of their money renting out camping spots short-term to a slew of seasonal clientele, but also of a selection of long-term residents on account of the town's lack of apartments. Euphoria had made a slow transition from village to town during an era when the detached single-family home, or townhouse when required, was still the dominant residential option everywhere but in the big cities. The latter 20th century boom in condos and ultra-high-rise apartment buildings had skipped Euphoria entirely on the way to more populous regions. While sliding the movies back onto their shelves, Freer devises both a plan and a backup plan to find out which trailer park the kids live in. The first plan is to draw out their stay for as long as possible and engage them in conversation, no matter how banal or seemingly irrelevant, to increase the chances they will say something that gives them away. When the kids arrive at the counter with their chosen films, Fur ambles as slowly as possible back to the cash register, drawling, "Be right with you." Finally in place, Fur thumbs through the cases, then taps demonstratively on the last with a blunt, decisive fingernail. "You don't want this one." "Why not?" Mal asks. A lock of hair, spiraled and tangled as Spanish moss, has sprung stubbornly free of Mal's hood. "You're wasting your money. It plays on cable every week." The kids look at each other. It occurs to Fear that teenagers probably don't watch much cable TV anymore. "What do you recommend, then?" Lim, whose bugging eyes and long, gangling legs are, more than anything else, reminiscent of a stick insect, inquires. "Glad you asked," Fear says, meandering back to the stock shelves as painfully as a tired seal through heavy sand. The kids do not follow. "This here," Fear declares upon returning minutes later. "What's it about?" Mal asks. "Someone witnesses a murder but decides not to report it and then is haunted by the victim's ghost," Fur answers, which is a liberal interpretation of the movie's basic premise. The kids look at each other again. Fur might be imagining their eyes narrowing. "Yeah, okay," Mal says, with a flippantness, casualness so flippant it sounds forced. Lim stares carefully at Fur as if searching for confirmation of subtext. "Great, can I interest you in some refreshments to accompany your film?" Fear has miscalculated a solicitous tone and realized there is nothing to do except proceed as if this interaction is entirely normal. "Popcorn?" The teenagers shake their heads. "Pretzels?" Shake. "Black licorice?" Shake. "Red licorice?" Shake. "Soda? We have orange, cola, root beer, cream." "We're good, thanks," Mal interjects. "All right then, just the movie." Fear is nervous and glances at the kids, who are unreadable. "Three movies, old releases, that'll be $10.50 for two nights. Let's see how much it'll be for five nights." Fur pulls out a calculator, despite already knowing that it will be $15.30. "We only need them for two nights," Lim says. "Are you sure? The longer you keep them, the more of a discount there is." "Two nights is enough," Mal reiterates. "All right then, three movies for two nights," Fur confirms. "Do you have an account with us?" "Yes," Lim answers. "What name is it under?" Lim spells it out. "Phone number?" Lim recites it. "Postal code?" Fur asks, face solidifying into an expression of indifference. Lim gives it. Success. Fear speeds through the rest of the transaction like a character in a film being fast-forwarded. "Thank you for visiting Utopia. Enjoy your movies. Come again anytime." Fear shoves the plastic bag full of movies towards the kids and beams in a way that could be mistaken for graciousness. With any luck, the kids will chalk up strangeness that evening to another instance of adults' enigmatic ways. Once the kids have left the store, Fear looks up the addresses of Euphoria's two trailer parks and matches the postal code Lim gave to the park north of the downtown. Fur stands illuminated for a moment by the store's fluorescent lights and the flush of success before blanching, realizing that the trailer park must have dozens of trailers and the postal code will do nothing to distinguish them. By the time Fur rushes out of the store, through the parking lot, to the road, the kids are nowhere in sight. It has been 1 year since the disappearance. If Fur's loss were a child, it would be on its feet talking by now. But Fear feels the pang of loss gut deep, as if it were just being born. And now you think I'm done, but you will continue to hear from me as I read our next reader's bio. So second up, we have Meg Freer, one of our wonderful local readers this evening, who grew up in Montana and lives in Ontario, where she is a writer, piano teacher, and editor. She was woken up one night in 2015 when what looked like a complete poem flashed in front of her eyes, even though she had never written poetry and didn't want to, which is proof that poetry is a kind of demon. Since then, her work has appeared in many journals, and she has published three poetry chapbooks. She proofreads for the Magnificent Arc Poetry, is co-poetry editor for the Sunlight Press, and belongs to the Ontario Poetry Society and the League of Canadian Poets, and she holds two music degrees and a graduate certificate in creative writing from Humber School of Writers. Welcome, Meg. you, Jade. It's really nice to be invited to be here with you and all the other readers. I've met some of them and some of them not. I'll start with two, I don't know, I guess you can call them appetizers. They're each exactly 53 words. So I do write poetry mostly. I do also write some prose. So I'm going to read a little bit of prose, a little bit of poetry. There is a monthly contest from Prime Number Magazine. They ask for 53-word stories. So I've had a couple of stories as monthly winners in the past from them, and it's a really fun little challenge. So this is called Cold War Paper. The large green and gold hotel room with views of Moscow's colored domes had only cold water in the marble sink, rough brown paper for the toilet. A woman at a desk handed us sheets of black market toilet paper when we passed. Coins we weren't supposed to give her sometimes made her smile. And this one, moving from, I guess, Moscow to here, Lake Ontario, it's called Taking Stock. The flock of geese whips about like a wayward kite string and pulls me to the lake where I cast off vanity into the frazzled ice at the shore. It pulses boldly in the waves and glitters appealingly like a discarded sequined dress, begging to be retrieved, but I don't want it anymore. Okay, now we're going out to Oregon, the west coast of Oregon. A little bit of, I don't know, micro nonfiction you could call this. Motorbike fear. A bad influence on us, our mother thought. Hard-drinking, cigar-smoking, motorcycle-riding Uncle Francis, with that wild look in his eyes, she was adamant he could not take us girls for a ride on his bike. Oh, how we were terrified at the thought of whizzing up and down the hilly streets of the Dalles and along the Columbia Gorge, where we might tumble off into the raging river, like the suitcases sliced off the car roof one summer by the serrated muscle of wind that blows down the gorge. The rocky shore flowered with our mother's silky underwear, and the river strewn with shirts and socks. And if our mother cried about broken suitcases, how much more she would grieve for our broken bodies if we fell off that bike. And no, we did not ride on a bike. This is a little bit of prose as well. I donated my record collection to the Kingston Symphony used record sale, a vinyl record sale a few years ago. And it was a little traumatic. I cried in the car when I went back to the car after I dropped off the last box. But anyway, this is called Elegy for My LPs. The performers look back at me from the album covers. Some smile sweetly or stare with defiant arrogance. Others appear pensive or academic. I pick up each record, study it, slide the disc out of its sleeve, read the liner notes. I have to let them go. I need the space. They need a true audiophile to appreciate them. An eclectic collection of mostly classical music. All are black vinyl except one, smaller and translucent reddish pink, the color of the inside of a beet, fittingly quirky for Poulenc. I almost keep that one. One is the size of a 45 RPM and the only one that does not preserve music. It records Albert Einstein, the great scientific genius discussing the most controversial issue of our times, the use of atomic energy. I realize I misremembered the title as The Use and Misuse of Atomic Energy. Embossed on the back, Rare Records Incorporated, collector's item, immortal voices, history-making events. It seems irreplaceable, so I keep it. I convert the other LPs into digital form and transfer these hours of precious music onto cold CDs. The vinyl never felt cold. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I met Jade in Toronto at the Transact Club. We were both reading during the launch of an issue of Vallum magazine, which is no more, sadly. And so the poem of mine, I thought I'd read the poem of mine that was in that Vallum issue that I read at the event. It's called Seeking Balance.
Locked in the psychiatric ward, the patients may or may not see Christmas lights this year, or get to brush their hair. But one has seen stigmata on her toes. She says alien life forms drew wavy brown lines on broccoli stems in her lunch, left on the floor of her room where they allow nothing that can be thrown. She offers me the vegetables, but I won't eat them either. When I won't get her out of there, she tells me who I am with a streak of righteousness, someone who is always busy doing nothing of significance. A priest walks through my fevered dreams, past bright colored shirts laid on the floor like lights, ready to be strung, wipes his runny nose. Even the holy are ill during Advent this year. In the setting sun, power lines like strings of lights shine on a hand-lettered sign tossed onto a snowbank, seeking someone who knows me. I don't know what the theme of that issue was. Do you remember? I have no idea.
Gosh, I don't anymore.
Anyway.
Like 5 years ago.
Okay, so I do have, as Jade said in my introduction, have three little chapbooks of poetry. This one is Serve the Sorrowing World with Joy, which I wrote with Chantal Lavoie, who's an RMC professor here in Kingston. It's all the proceeds of this book go back to the Sisters of the Providence towards their campaign to build a new center for the St. Vincent de Paul Society. And these poems honor their work and their legacy here in Kingston. They were they are nuns who live in the community, and they do really great community work. They have an incredible legacy. This is Still Life Waiting, Notes on a Ghost Town. It's another honoring book, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Honors the residents of a mining town in Montana near where I grew up, and has photos and poems. If you have any connection to mining towns, you might find this interesting. I'll just read one poem from this, and then I'll read something, a little bit from this book, and then we'll go on to the next reader. Double jacking. Two miners, sledgehammers, handheld drills, 280-foot deep timbered incline shaft. 3 to 4 feet dug, $1 or $2 pay. 9 out of 10 carts, waste rock. One mistake, injury, or death. So that's life in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Montana mining town. This is called A Man of Integrity. If you have any wine enthusiasts or wine experts in your family or friend circle, they might enjoy this book. It's about another honoring a person book. A man from Spain, a young man from Spain who came to the U.S. to make his fortune, and indeed he made his fortune. He went to Hollywood, but he was not an actor. He hobnobbed with all the rich and famous in Hollywood as a restaurateur and a wine maker, essentially. He was a wine pioneer, and if you find his wine, his name is Jean Leon. His wine is now made by the... His legacy is now taken over by the Torres family in Spain. And they have really award-winning wine. So this 3055 wine label caught my attention in the LCBO one time. And I love wine labels. And the wine was incredible. And I looked up the man's legacy, his story, tried to find out about him, and wrote some poems about him and his wine. So 3055... Actually, I don't think you can even find it at the LCBO anymore. I buy it in the U.S. when I go, but it's a really good wine if you ever find it. He, as I said, hobnobbed with all the rich and famous. This is called La Scala. A springboard to fame in 1956. You hit it off with James Dean, and you two plan the most luxurious restaurant of its time, La Scala, in Beverly Hills. Before you can sign papers, tragedy marks your life again. And Dean, who had said, live as if you'll die today, is dead. His gray Porsche, little bastard, crumpled like a ball of tinfoil on Highway 46. You open La Scala anyway, serve Spanish paella and pane di campagne, bread of peasants who work in the fields, Italian bread served nowhere else at that time. And your rule at La Scala is the same for all, no matter how famous. All members of a party must be present in order to be seated. That's where the man of integrity, part of where the man of integrity title comes in that I made up. This is the last poem in the collection about John Leon. That was not his real name, by the way. That was a Hollywood name he came up with for his acting auditions. Legacy. What charisma to be friends with presidents, sit with Nixon as he loses his presidential bid, discuss Spanish politics with Kennedy, have your chef flown in for state dinners, your Cabernet served at Reagan's inauguration. But cancer knows nothing of charisma, wants no company. You sailed alone on your yacht for 2 years until death, pondered your life, a Spanish boy who made it in Hollywood. Did you pray to the patron saint of wine producers for a legacy to live on in vineyards and on wine labels? A man, smooth and subtle, a wine of earth and velvet, the quiet power of vermilion, a time of sophistication. Thanks.
Meg, you said something about keeping busy, doing nothing of significance, and I feel we can probably all relate to that at times. Our next reader is Mina Wallen, who is joining us from Toronto, which is very exciting. And this is actually also the launch of her recent collection, The Suicide Tourist, which is her fourth book of poetry. So Mina Wallen, a Toronto-born poet and prose writer, was published in the Antigonish Review, Vallum Magazine, Miramichi Reader, League of Canadian Poets, chapbook On the Storm and the Struggle, Event Magazine, and the Literary Review of Canada, among others. Anatomy of an Injury, her third book, was published by Inanna Publications in 2018. Wallen was longlisted for the 2022 Nick Blatchford Occasional Verse Contest. Her short fiction, Crackerjacks, received an honorable mention in Esoterica Magazine's Inaugural Fiction Contest 2023, and her fourth book, The Suicide Tourist, was published in June 2024 by Ecstasis Editions.
Thank you, Jane. I want to say thanks, everyone, for coming out. It's really good turnout, and it's very gratifying. Okay, so, yeah, this is my book, and it's got this wonderful piece of art that looks kind of happy and joyous until you realize the woman has no arms. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's kind of suitable for this for this collection. It's about mental health, mental illness. I never know which term to use. So I use them both with a slash between them. Anyway, I've got five poems. I'll be quick. The first one is a little odd. I took... if any of you saw Cats... And you remember the song McCavity, the mystery cat. McCavity, McCavity. So somewhere in my brain, I thought that the worst medication I ever took had the same number of syllables. So I wrote Olanzapine. And I know you're not supposed to rhyme in poetry, but I broke that rule for this poem. Olanzapine, olanzapine, there were dragons in your mead. I trusted you once and once again, a cherub-visaged fiend. Like Alice when she was falling, like Alice when she was small, I did not have a chance, my friend. You pinned me against a wall. Olanzapine, olanzapine, pharmaceutically stiff and strong. You promised peace and sleep at night. Instead, my nights were long. A monster of depravity, you tangled my tongue until I was serpent-like myself, all my insides wrung. Accomplishing the opposite, half asleep, awake, searching for some sanity, a file hidden in a cake. Olanzapine, olanzapine, deceitfulness and suavity. You promised me some peace of mind. Instead, I found a dark gravity. I could not court a calming place. Olanzapine would not deliver. Caught on choppy waters, a hyperactive river. Olanzapine's a narcissist. Olanzapine doesn't care. He earns money with every prescription, in every psychiatrist's lair. Olanzapine is terrible. Olanzapine is vile. Colors the world psychosis crimson, mile after bloody mile. And just so you are well advised, Abilify is heinous too. Sleepwalking in a toxic funk, speaking gibberish. I don't remember it at all, my dark dalliance in the night. Confusion reigned and ruled my thoughts, a growing parasite. Olanzapine, Abilify, your poisonous, dank deliverance. Sort of funny. This is also sort of weirdly funny because I was put in an institution for a number of weeks, but they hadn't built it yet. So it was just sort of rooms without handles and no clocks and no pictures and an army of people kind of putting it together as I was there. So that's what this is. The Last Resort Hotel. A new ward was being erected around us like a film set. Hammering, drilling, painting. A locksmith performed magic on the main entranceway next to the nurse's station. A big clock was hung in the day room, marking the beginning of the long wait for meals, for visitors, for day passes. Doctors, nurses, and social workers hit their marks, consulting charts, while only a handful of us in various states of disrepair had signed in. We tried to oblige a young fellow who kept changing his name. Was it Leo? Leopold? Louis III? Or Luigi? Obsessed with hip-hop videos and Instagram, he never ate. Nurses kept inquiring, "Have you eaten today, Leo?" A tall, slim, raccoon-bruised woman emerged. I didn't know where to look. A guileless male patient asked what happened. "I did a really stupid thing," the woman said. "What did you do?" he prodded. "Tried to kill myself." She tried to describe the positioning, the falling, but it became a jumble of, "Oh, I can't explain this." "You don't have to answer," we told her. "It's no one's business." A paranoid old man could hear lousy communists whispering in the corner. While in the middle of a manic bout, I threw shoes, shouting through walls, "Fuck this place, I'm getting worse." The doctors toyed with my nightly cocktail. Sleep was my Everest. I had too much energy. Night nurses cajoled me, but the bed felt smothering. Blankets trapped me, straitjacketed, a confusion of thoughts still worrying. I told my psychiatrist I was a published poet. He raised an eyebrow, a question mark. It never occurred to me he might think me delusional. Obsessed with laundry, cleanliness, I slid on toasted socks from the dryer daily. The more unstable I felt, the cleaner I needed to be. Every morning at 6 a.m., I showered before everyone, hoping the searing water would purify and wash the crazy off. I went to breakfast as morning light streamed in, stabbed a deflated pancake, sipped a perversely weak mug of coffee, and pretended to be a guest in a fancy hotel. I don't know. Here it goes. Well, I kind of dreamt this and then went with it. so it's a little dreamlike. An explosion of roses. One. I dreamt I was in a mental hospital where an anorexic man caused a disturbance, waking up other patients in the night. The head nurse decided to take drastic action, ordered him blown out of a cannon. He flew and transformed into an explosion of roses. The other patients revolted, carrying elaborate sketches of him they drew in art therapy, with flowers sprouting from his face, his body. They said if he could be sacrificed, then none of us was safe, urged me to join in the rebellion. Unmoved, I said, I can think of worse ways to go. Don't we all feed the roses eventually? There was something quixotic about his death. Many depressives on the floor envied his sudden and spectacular end, since they spent most of their free time fantasizing about suicide. When I awoke from my dream within a dream, there was a cactus and a card embellished with flowers on my nightstand. I closed my eyes and saw roses everywhere. Two. When I awoke, I wasn't on the psychiatric ward. It had been a year since I'd taken that excursion. My orchids were blooming yellow and white. I had a big vase of purple tulips summoning spring. Thrilled at finally remembering one, I described my dream to the psychiatrist, and he scribbled down the gory details but failed to ask me what the cannon signified, or the roses, for that matter. If he were a Freudian, he could chew over that dream like a sumptuous meal. But it came and went along with the confessions I shared. He suggested I buy a dozen roses on the way home. So this seems like it's taking... I don't want to take too long. So I always do this. I skip a poem. Do you want to hear school, project, or late?
Both. Yeah.
All right. They're both short. School project. Everyone against it. My teacher, speechless. My parents, aghast. But I was determined. In seventh grade, I constructed a miniature gallows. The assignment, make something from another era. A butter churn, for example. Or a crude spinning wheel. My father helped with the measurements for the tiny scaffold, finding just the right little hinge for its trap door. When you pulled the hangman's knotted noose, the door opened its wooden mouth. It had three stairs for my imaginary criminal to climb. So proud of my gallows, I kept it on display on my bedroom bureau next to my seashell collection and spirograph drawings. I kept my Ouija board tucked in the closet, too dangerous for the board and the gallows to meet. We had crafted it together in my father's workshop, smelling of old spice, cigarettes, and sawdust, a mysterious basement nook far away from my mother's hectoring, where he had intense conversations with his tools. That sounds sexual, but it's not. This is short, and I think it puts a nice sort of coda on the whole thing. It's called Late, and it starts with an epigraph by Edgar Allan Poe from Eleonora. Those who dream by day are cognizant of many things which escape those who dream only by night, which always makes me feel better because I dream during the day. It's a confusing one. Never mind. You stay up all night listening to the quiet, hearing your rumination and heart beat simultaneously, savoring the stillness or wind hissing in the trees, raccoons snarling, rustle scavenging, the screech of a skunk chasing its mate. Memories flit up and away like ghosts. At night, alone means its opposite. time suspended, the breath held. You fight that surrender of consciousness, then fall hard until you crawl out of your boudoir, squinting at the afternoon night. You can't know what night is until you've embraced it like a wicked deed you've made your own. You need some darkness inside to appreciate the approaching black as it descends all around. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that, Mina. I was thinking as you were reading the poem about the school project, I was like, there's really a certain kind of dad who, like, if you give them a project to help you with, they're so supportive.
So true.
Okay, next, we are going to hear from Ashley Elizabeth Best, whose poetry I have read before, but I have never heard her read it, so I'm very excited to hear. So Ashley Elizabeth Best is a disabled poet and essayist from right here in Kingston, Ontario. Her work can be found in the Capilano Review, New Welsh Review, CB2, Ambit, Mislexia, and Chatelaine. Recently, she was a finalist for the CBC Literary Award for Poetry. She is the author of two poetry collections, Bad Weather Mammals, which is forthcoming in September 2024, and Slow States of Collapse, 2016, both from ECW Press. Welcome.
Excited to be here. I feel like I'm here every other week, but I actually just finally got some copies of the book, and it's the cover of my dreams. It's called Bone Dress by one of my favorite Louisiana photographers. She does some really interesting work. This will be available in September. So I'll read a couple poems from this, and then I'll attempt to read a new one. So this book is... can be a little heavy. It's about being disabled, the joys and devastations of that, living within these... Actually, I should just read the back. It's pretty great. infuses government forms with lyric poetry, suggesting all the ways the medical and bureaucratic systems can dehumanize and traumatize our most vulnerable citizens. So as a person who has been in and out of multiple systems my entire life, I feel like it's important to write about it. I don't think we often get to hear from people who have to subsist on ODSP, welfare. The income provided by those agencies is barely, it's not even enough to pay rent and food anymore. So, I feel like it's important to write about. And I'll just launch right in. And also, thank you, Jade, for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here. So, this poem is called The Best Thing About Today Is It Is a Feeling and It Won't Last. I'm not sorry anymore that she doesn't like her life. My poems dispirited by her, thick mentions of road trips and landscapes and pissing into lace stacks canisters while stuck in traffic. Today, my mother sent me a framed picture of her heart, ladybug stickers in each corner, a chest preparing for new growth. My kitchen lights flicker, the pulse of my mother's heart on the ultrasound machine. It is a day where everything contains the possibility of her, of the heart she is trying to salvage. Who else would understand the tease of her laugh, or decipher an ultrasound image of a heart, a letter you're too embarrassed to read twice? I grew up, I have four younger siblings, and I grew up with a disabled mother who lived on disability, and she's always had a myriad of health issues, some which have been exaggerated, some which are legitimate. So my next book is actually quite, it's basically about her. so there's some mentions of that in here as well. This next one is called Proud Flesh, and proud flesh is like basically like a scar tissue that's left over for surgeries. A month after my release, I cut my hair short and studied the heart of a blue whale. I thought of how easily I could crawl inside and pound the taut lining until everyone at the ROM fought me alive again in my heart shroud. My eyes redden on capillaries. Blessed are those who are seen and not silent. Here a rose in the vase of a blue heart. I finger dry stitches on my belly, imagine turning inside out, the stuff coming out like roots, like thread, the inside of a mackerel, the fine gut, the same color, just like that. I'm glad I used tabs. This next one is called prodromal, and thank you to Sadiqa for introducing me to that concept and the word. The worst feeling is being recovered and sensing another episode coming on. It's the scale, not the words. Plant your canines in the most tender of those anticipations. Pain will make it all clear. There's always a fallow before the fall, the body a predetermined landscape, a consequence of living. There's never any question. You must always lift yourself out. You want everyone to know what you've done, but not how you did it. You don't blame anyone. The heart is a small sun in which you burn with forgiveness. You didn't believe in backbones until Papa showed you how to pull life from a body, the spine of a fish. The thaw is always further upstream than the melt. And a fun part of, you know, this book, or I also work for Brick Books, so I'm familiar with layouts and stuff, is just, you know, it sounds fun to make, like, little fun poems that look cool on the page, but then the formatting is a nightmare, getting it in the book. So there's just two poems that are a landscape in the book. I think it was worth it, though. Okay. This one is called Absence. Stopped eating. Picked my bones clean with health, transforming myself with lists, boiled my organs with pots of burdock and dandelion roots, charted thickets of soil with my taste buds, tracks of poison, of plastic entwined at the root. Refuse olfactory pleasures, sampling soil, a vessel, a garden, a new stratum. Speak only to differentiate between layers, bones nailed to igneous rock. The smallest crops can give the most at harvest, like the girl who lived 3,700 years ago, her DNA extracted from chewed birch pitch. Consider your teeth in the earth's belly, their usefulness in decoding what you may never know about yourself. Your usefulness may outlive you. Mica reflects back on your own wildness, each unearthed form its own astonishment. My grandparents lived, well, my grandfather was born in Bancroft, so I spent a lot of time up there. The mineral capital of Ontario or whatever. So I have a large rock collection. This poem doesn't really have a title yet. I just sort of finished a first draft of my next book, which is tentatively, for granting purposes, titled Bullet Points. It's about sort of home as a concept, which is wide, but surviving gun violence and then sort of coming out of that and thinking about maybe having a baby and what that means as someone who's disabled, endometriosis and all the fun things that, you know, reproductively, they're like, that might not happen. So it's, yeah, reconciling, like, new life with trauma and all these other things that I already had to deal with. So, but I'm hoping that it's a bit more joyful. You know, my sister had a baby a year ago, my nephew, and I've been pretty involved with his upbringing, so he will make an appearance, and he's joyful. Mm-hmm. I wrote this after reading Victoria Chang's new collection. I keep a log of all the days I bleed, this being only the third month in almost 20 years. I don't remember how a shedding uterus behaves, but if estranged from the present, I can chase the bodies I have been housed in. My mother's, and as an egg, a grandmother not worth knowing. Victoria Chang says, grieving starts long before we're born. Litany of neglect and violence condensed into the minutiae of cells from homes you never signed a lease to live in. As long as I took the hormones, abstained from the monthly ritual of womanhood, I could forget about the future housed in my own ovaries. This first draft, which is always the final draft, pedaling through waters of time, lifespans waving out to coalesce against distant shores beyond our sight. That's everything, and yeah, thanks for having me.
Get some lipstick with it.
Thank you so much for that, Ashley Elizabeth. Those were lovely poems.
I guess we're already at our final reader for the evening. I want the best for last because everyone is amazing, of course. But we do have a prestigious author among us who is the author of 31 books, including the essay collection Imagining, which is here, essays on language, identity, infinity, and the forthcoming scandal at the Alphorn Factory, which I just learned how to pronounce today, new and selected short fiction 2024 to 1984, and with Lillian Allen and Gregory Betts, Mutter Tongue. And despite having 31 books, I think this is Gary's first time reading in Kingston.
It is.
So this is very exciting for us. His national best-selling novel, Yiddish for Pirates, which won the Leacock Medal and the Canadian Jewish Literary Award, was a finalist for the Governor General's Award and the Giller Prize and was longlisted for Canada Reads. His most recent novel, Nothing the Same, Everything Haunted, that's this one here, won the Canadian Jewish Literary Award and was the Hamilton Reads Choice for 2023-24. He lives in Hamilton. Gary Barwin, everybody.
It was really nice to be here. I've been in this bookstore a bunch of times, but I've never, because I've been to Kingston before, but I've never read here. So I'm really delighted. And thanks for inviting me, and thanks everyone for coming. I was trying to decide what to read. I look at the audience and decide what seems right. So I was going to read a thoughtful essay about language, but instead we had sex with a golem. This just seems right. So it does describe, this is actually in that book, that collection of short fictions coming up, but it was also in Best Canadian Stories, so I have a copy here. So a golem is, there's Gollum, right, the Lord of the Rings Hobbit Gollum, but that's the golem is a figure from Jewish mythology. I explained a bit about it in here, but he's a creature made out of clay, sort of with magic, using words which is mentioned there, that they put on the tongue or sometimes put on the forehead and makes come to life, and then it helps and then is usually deactivated or decommissioned or whatever you do with monsters. There's a famous one, it's from Jewish folklore, but it's a famous one in the 16th century in Prague. There's a golem of Prague. But I really like this character. I'm interested in looking at some kinds of Jewish elements from Jewish folklore and to kind of examine them for what, I don't know, what they might tell us about being human, about identity. And I also like these characters that are sort of liminal. I mean, a golem is alive, and it's a kind of a monster, but it's a helpful monster. But it's like, it's slightly Frankensteinian in the sense that it's got its own emotions and sometimes gets out of control. So what is that? In what way is that human? In what way is it like a human? It's all of that. And it's made out of clay. Adam in the Bible was made out of clay, so there's that connection too. It starts with a misquote from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein that appeared in Kenneth Branagh's movie Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. There is love in me the likes of which you've never seen. Night. I was waiting on a bench, on the sidewalk, in the fog. Toronto, Eglinton, near Dufferin, outside a music store, its windows filled with accordions, lurid red plastic trumpets, and an LP of Que Sera, Sera, leaning against some maracas. It was a fitting theme song for the students who passed through the little back room taking lessons with Pasquale, at least in terms of the uncertain melodies they produced with their nervous, ill-prepared fingers. But kids, who knew what those fingers were capable of now? The future's not ours to see, after all. It may possibly be filled with skilled accordionists. But night and fog, the music store mute. He was walking down the street, moving between clouds of lamp-lit luminosity and obscurity, wearing a dark suit and a bowler hat, like Magritte or the man in his paintings, and like me. Kidding, in a bowler hat, I'd look more like an aging droog. He moved toward me with no kind of expression on his face, but I saw he was a form of regret made manifest, one of my many regrets. Usually they're not so dapper. My golem I hadn't seen him for years. Mm. We'd lost touch, and in a way, I was surprised I recognized him, surprised he was still alive. I didn't think golems could live so long. We had been close once, twins, lovers of a kind even. No, we never were.